All right. Welcome back. I'm going to give you a little teaser. I have four bingo words, so get your sheets out. I've got four here, okay? We need some winners. So your first bingo word is Miami Heat. Check those cards, Miami Heat. I hope some of you are playing multiple cards. Who's with me? Okay. All right. So Miami Heat, number one. Number two, R-H-O-M, our Real Housewives of Miami. Number three, where the party's at, the Frost Museum. And last but not least, I'm waiting for a bingo here, guys, scuba diving. Again, those four words for those of you just coming in: Miami Heat, Real Housewives of Miami, Frost Museum, and scuba diving. So my name is Kristen Rigg. I'm here to announce our next speaker, Dr. Matthew Zyrus. His practice focuses on dermatitis, itch, and difficult patients referred from other dermatologists. He's handing out his number after the lecture, just in case you wanted to know. No, just kidding. So one of the most important moments of Dr. Zyrus' life happened while he was a young dermatologist and realized that so much of what he was being taught to tell patients about atopic dermatitis did not have any proof to back it up. Even worse was that much of what he was supposed to tell them either didn't work or was making their problems worse. At that moment, he started looking for what actual causes for what he was seeing in his patients and for explanations that made sense. This man really doesn't need an introduction, but please help me welcome to the stage Dr. Matthew Zyrus.
All right, so thank you, everybody. I am so excited to give this talk. It really has become such a fascinating thing to me how well we can treat atopic dermatitis now, and it makes me realize how bad we were at it 5 years ago, right, until we got our first drug in dupilumab, and we really have amazing, amazing options now, and they really are different from each other. It's very different from the psoriasis space, where, I hate to put it this way, the shared decision-making that I do in psoriasis is really shared decision-making between me and my biologics coordinator. Because the drugs are all very similar, they're all great, but they're all so similar to each other that there's not a lot of matching the right patient to the right drug. In atopic dermatitis, there is a huge amount of matching the right patient to the right drug. And that's really what I want to prepare you for. And so the way that I have come to think about atopic dermatitis is I'm a matchmaker. And when I think of me as a matchmaker, for some reason, what's in my head is always a girl asking me if I have any guys to set her up with. And so I think of whenever I see an eczema patient as them coming into the room and being like, hi, I've got eczema. Do you have any cute drugs you could set me up with? Right? And the reason that is really important is that I always thought there would be a like, okay, there's a best drug, that's what I start everybody on, and then if that doesn't work, I'll go. That is absolutely not how it works, right? The way that it works, because that isn't what you would do as a matchmaker with trying to set somebody up for a relationship. You wouldn't say, well, there's one person that I set everybody up with, and then if they break up with you, then I'll set you up with the next person. Like, no, you find out from them what matters to you, right? What matters? Do you want somebody who's emotionally stable? Do you want somebody who's rich? Do you want somebody who's good looking? Does it matter what kind of a car they drive? Like, you set different people up with different drugs, right? And so what I'm trying to do today is teach you about the options. So that then whenever you see a patient who's appropriate, you can tell them, hey, here are the drugs I could set you up with. Which one sounds best to you? All right, that's really, because it's never me choosing the drug. It is the patient choosing the drug, all right? And so that's what I want to prepare you for, is to be able to really set the patient up with the right drug. Right, so atopic dermatitis 2022, the movie version, way shorter than the book. Disclosures. I work with, you know, just about every company out there. I do clinical trials. All of these drugs are drugs I've been using for years, so I have lots of clinical experience with them. And the summary of recommendations, right? So I always like to kind of start with the punchline, and then I'm going to go through and kind of explain to you why I'm saying what I'm saying. So dupilumab, for people, so first, if somebody has concomitant asthma, significant allergy, or molluscum, dupilumab is your go-to drug. that's really what you should be encouraging them to go on. And then second, unless a patient has a preference for one of the other drugs, dupilumab is the drug that makes the most sense. And why is that? Because we have the most data, we have the most clinical experience. I would say all of the drugs that I'm going to set people up with are good drugs. Are good, you know, in my setting people up scenario, they're good guys, right? And so dupilumab is the guy that you've known the longest, right? Childhood friend, known him forever, really know what to expect from them, not going to turn, you know, no, you're the most certain about dupilumab, all right? Tralokinumab, I think of tralokinumab as having the lowest risk for annoying side effects. It is a little less certain to work. We don't know how much less certain. So I actually think of all four of these drugs as very similar in efficacy once we get out to about 32 weeks. I do think that the JAK inhibitors work. So if we were to say efficacy at 12 weeks or even 4 weeks, I think a JAK inhibitor is our best drug. I think if we get out to 16 weeks, now dupilumab is very similar to a JAK inhibitor in terms of efficacy. And when we get out to 32 weeks, I think that tralokinumab is right there as well. And so with tralokinumab, the give up is a slower drug, but the selling point for tralokinumab is that there's a real chance they're going to be able to go to doing injections once every 4 weeks, right? So that really does make a big difference to a lot of patients, right? I'm going to try and give you what are the real major differentiating factors. Major differentiating factor for tralokinumab is that you can go to every 4 weeks. And then people who had a inadequate response to or a side effect from dupilumab, very reasonable to try tralokinumab. We don't have a lot of data or experience yet. Does inadequate response to dupilumab predict inadequate response to tralokinumab? We don't know. If you got a side effect, if you got dupilumab red face or conjunctivitis, are you going to get it if you go on tralokinumab? Not a lot of data out there yet. Just don't really know. And then a systemic JAK inhibitor. So if somebody has concomitant rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis or sebderm or psoriatic arthritis, then a JAK inhibitor makes the most sense because that now you're killing two birds with one stone, right? So that makes a lot of sense there. Patients who are highly needle phobic, right? So the biggest thing that makes a patient in my practice choose a JAK inhibitor as their first line drug is that they're not going to have to give themselves a shot every 2 weeks. They're going to have to get some blood work, but it's way less than giving themselves a shot every 2 weeks. And so that's the primary deciding factor for a JAK inhibitor. Also, people who want the fastest results and are willing to accept a little bit of immunosuppression to get it. Patients who had an inadequate response or side effect from dupilumab, and we do have some data about does dupilumab inadequate response predict a less response to a JAK inhibitor than expected. And again, I'll give you the answer. We have that data around abrocitinib. And I will use some brand names because if you don't know which drug I'm talking about, abrocitinib is Cibinqo. We do have some data around dupilumab inadequate responders, what happens whenever they go on Cibinqo. And then not for people who have a personal history of DVT or PE or those who are ultra high cardiovascular risk. Again, I'm going to give you a punchline that I'm going to prove to you as I go forward. There is no increased risk of VTE, MACE, mortality with JAK inhibitors used in dermatology for atopic derm. There is not one bit of data anywhere in the world that has shown an increased risk of any of those things. Okay, now, I do say that to patients. I say, you're going to get these warnings from the pharmacy that talk about really scary things like heart attacks and strokes and blood clots and death. That's because a distantly related medication used for people who don't have eczema did increase those risks. But we have tons of information about the medication we're talking about for you, and none of that information has shown any increase in risk. Okay, now notice I did not say it has been proven there is no risk, because to be proven there is no increased risk, we would have to have a specially designed study that was a 5-year controlled study with 5,000 people in it that is probably never going to get done. And even if it does get done, it doesn't help us now. We need to make decisions now. But all of the data, the thousands and thousands and thousands of years of patient exposure that we have, has not shown any increased risk of VTE, MACE, mortality with the JAK inhibitors that we have in atopic dermatitis to use that we have in atopic dermatitis, in dermatology to use for atopic dermatitis. All right, so next, rethinking, and we're going to go back through all of that, but rethinking atopic dermatitis, right? So 7.2% of adults in the United States have atopic dermatitis. 3% of adults in the U.S. have psoriasis. That is a really important comparison to make because it means you should have 2 to 3 times, if you add up all the patients you have on a biologic or a systemic agent for psoriasis, you should have twice as many people on systemics for atopic derm. I think that is highly unlikely, right? The number of people who I meet who say to me, I really love that we've got these new drugs for atopic dermatitis. I've got my 6 atopic dermatitis patients on things that they're doing wonderfully, but I just don't see that much atopic derm. You do see a lot of atopic derm. You see a lot more atopic derm than you're realizing. And I'm going to go through how we think about that now, right? So the way that we now think about it. So this was a table from an article that came out this year coining the phrase the atopic spectrum disorder, right? So kind of a jump off from the idea of the autism spectrum disorder. But really, we shouldn't be using, you should not be using terms like dermatitis NOS, eczema, dermatitis unspecified, nummular eczema, or other nonspecific terms anymore. Really, if it is spongiotic dermatitis, it is atopic dermatitis unless proven otherwise. That is really the way that we should be thinking about it now, right? So there really are 4 types of eczema or sponge derm: atopic derm, seb derm, contact derm, and stasis derm. And you think of the term eczema the same way you think of the term headache, right? So if somebody says, you know, my head hurts, okay, you've got a headache. If it's a migraine headache, then that tells me there are specific treatments that are going to work. And it tells me specific things about how it's going to behave. We now think of atopic dermatitis in the same way. It's a specific type of dermatitis that then allows us to use specific medications, right? So, but the vast majority of dermatitis is atopic dermatitis. And this is from, the FDA has really pushed this on us. So the FDA has made the drug companies use either the AAD consensus criteria or the Hanifin and Reika criteria. So these are now the criteria that really define what atopic dermatitis is. So this was in 2014, and the essential features, pruritus, eczema, which means spongiotic dermatitis, in a typical age-specific pattern. Well, what are the typical age-specific patterns? Number 3 is the really important one. Spares the groin and axilla. So now the next, we have important features. The important features are not necessary. So really, the essential features are what they must have: sponge derm, chronic, spares the groin and axilla. Now, on top of that, you have to remember the exclusionary conditions that you don't think it's scabies, you don't think it's contact derm, you don't think that it's psoriasis that's eczematized. But really what it comes down to, sponge derm, chronic, spares the groin and axilla, that is atopic dermatitis, unless you think it's contact derm, right? And is really what it comes down to. And it's easy to relatively rule out contact derm whenever we're talking about a scattered generalized dermatitis, right? You rule out contact derm by having somebody use a low allergenicity soap like Dove. Dove Bar, don't use Dove liquid. Dove Bar is much lower allergenicity. So Dove Bar, you know, Cetaphil, CeraVe, Eucerin, Aveeno, a high-end moisturizer that you know isn't going to have significant contact allergens in it. And if they don't get better, there really aren't many other contact allergens that are spread widely over your body, right? So it's not that difficult to, you don't have to do comprehensive patch testing in everyone. So and again, boiling it down, I already said this, in the old days, you said, I will call it atopic derm if they had eczema as a child and they have a personal history of atopy. Neither of those are necessary. The diagnostic criteria that the FDA has said this is atopic derm, you don't have to have had it as a child, you don't have to have a personal history of atopy. So when you see sponge derm, you really should be assuming this is atopic derm. So when you see sponge derm, I'm calling this atopic derm unless I'm convinced it's one of these, right? One of the exclusionary criteria and or diseases. And do you have to do a biopsy? No. Do you have to do patch testing? No. We are clinicians. We are very good at what we do. So we can look at these people and say, do I think this is contact derm? Do I think this is psoriasis? Right? You don't need to biopsy people. You don't need to patch test them. But you need to think through this. All right, so now onward to treatment. Before we get too far into treatment and differentiating the drugs, one of the thoughts, who is a candidate for systemic therapy? And the thing that I really want to get across, it's not just about quality of life. Right, so quality of life is huge in atopic dermatitis, right? There's very little in the world of dermatology that is worse than moderate to severe atopic dermatitis in terms of impacting people's lives, but that's not all that it's about, right? The other thing is that these people are at very high risk for infections, very high risk, and treating moderate to severe atopic dermatitis with effective therapy that's not immunosuppressive, so particularly the biologics, really reduces that risk of infection. So it basically cuts it in half. And that is a really powerful thing for me to tell patients whenever they're pushing back on me, basically, and we're going to get to how do I talk to patients about atopic dermatitis, how do I talk to them about treatment. That's one of the most powerful statements that I have in the people who are really pushing back is this is going to reduce your risk of getting infections. You people on this drug get fewer infections than people not on it. And I actually tell people, we're all very comfortable now with the idea that dupilumab and tralokinumab are not immunosuppressive. I tell them not only are they not immunosuppressive, they make your immune system work better, right? And how do they make your immune system work better? We're going to get to that as we go forward some. But very specifically, they increase antimicrobial peptide production. Antimicrobial peptides are your body's first-line immunologic defense against skin infections. IL-13 causes a decrease in antimicrobial peptide production. When you block IL-13, antimicrobial peptide production goes up. It is very reasonable to say that is your immune system working better, right? So it's just a really interesting way to be able to put this. So moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, second biggest risk factor there is for a positive blood culture. There's an annual risk of 1.5 to 2% of getting a serious infection, meaning an infection that lands you at least in the hospital overnight. And the risk of death is increased by 62% in those who've ever had phototherapy or use of any systemic agent, right? Now, that's me trying to make it sound as bad as I can when I say there's a 62% increase in death. Well, you can have a 100% increase in your chances of winning the Powerball by buying two tickets. You still don't think, you're still pretty damn unlikely to win the Powerball because you bought two tickets. So that 62% increased risk of death, the absolute risk is really small, but the data, whenever we look at it, it is really meaningful. Right? So it's really simple. In the studies looking at this, they define the severity of atopic dermatitis by treatment history. So having ever needed a systemic or even needing an ultra-high class steroid, so a clobetasol, puts you in the high-risk group. Right? So we can say that anybody who has ever needed a systemic agent, it is very appropriate to treat them with an FDA-approved systemic agent for atopic dermatitis. Right? So anybody who's ever needed a shot of Kenalog or a Medrol dose pack or some prednisone is appropriate for the systemic therapies that we have. And so this is a very busy slide. I basically put it in there so that if you're not believing what I'm, if you're not buying what I'm selling, these are the studies that this is based on that talk about how they broke people into who's moderate, who's severe, and shows the data around infections, right? So just this is more for the supporting what I'm saying so that it's not just, hey, I heard Matt Zaire say this at a conference. I don't know if he really was like blowing smoke or what, but here's the actual data, all right? And then another really interesting question now is what's the right endpoint, right? So easy. So if you said to a patient, would you rather get 50% better or 75%? Oh, I'd rather get 75%. How about 75% versus 90? Oh, I'd rather get 90%. What about 90? I would rather get 100%. What if it will grow hair and make you look younger? We'll get you 120% better. That's the drug that I want, right? Patients are always going to, right? Better always sounds better. So we have all these different endpoints we can look at. I'm a real believer that EASI 75 is the right endpoint, and here's why. So this is data that I really, really like. So on the lower left, this is the number of people who stopped bothering to put on topical steroids. So you had given them topical steroids for free, said, put these on anywhere you have eczema. These are the percentage of people who stopped using it. It is just about identical in that same study to the number of people who got to EASI 75. So if you got to EASI 75, you stopped, but it was too much of a hassle to screw the cap off, put a little steroid on, right? So EASI 75 is the point at which people stop bothering to put on topical steroid. That tells me that is the endpoint that matters the most to me. And so as we go through the rest of this, because we could focus on lots of different endpoints, EASI 75 is going to be the primary endpoint that I focus on. Now, differentiating the approved therapies. This is a meta-analysis. So this website, eczematherapies.com /research, really looks at all of the data and tries to put the drugs in a position of efficacy, right? So really, and based on experience with these drugs, I agree with the general order. I think that the magnitudes we know are off because we do now have some head-to-head data that tells us exactly what the difference is between some of these drugs. But in general, I do agree with this. So the two most effective drugs that we have, abrocitinib 200 milligrams and upadacitinib 30 milligrams. So those two are the most effective things that we have. Next, dupilumab and abrocitinib 100 milligrams, upadacitinib 15 milligrams are all about equal at 16 weeks. And then tralokinumab, so far based on the data, a little less effective at 16 weeks. It's my belief that if we take that out to 32 weeks, it does probably get to be just as good as the other drugs. So a little bit slower of a drug, but still gets to the same range of efficacy as everything else that we have. And then this was just another really interesting thing. So we talk about itch, so NRS scores, and we talk about EASI scores. And the big takeaway was that they correlate almost perfectly. So you don't, at this point, need to talk about how well does it work for rash, how well does it work for itch. Once you know how well it works for rash, you know how well it works for itch. Once you know how well it works for itch, you know how well it works for rash. That is the takeaway of this slide. Again, the getting into the weeds of the data, not that important, but just the idea that you don't need to think separately. You can think, if you know how good it works for EASI score, you know how good it works for IGA score, or for NRS. Now, how to talk to patients about their disease and options. So I'm a huge, huge believer in shared decision making. And shared decision making, whenever you do it, the best way to do it with patients, you give them two choices, right? So A or B. I never do, hey, we've got five different things we could do. Let me tell you about all five, then you tell me which one sounds. Patients cannot do that, right? At least the vast majority of them. Some can, right? If they're a physician or they're a PhD, you know, microbiologist, maybe they, but the vast majority of patients, you want two options and you want three bullet points per option. Not three sentences, not a paragraph, not all the data that's out there. You want two options, A or B, and you want three bullet points, right? So first, though, how I explain atopic dermatitis to a patient. So the way I explain atopic dermatitis to a patient, all right, so I always use Mrs. Smith as my patient, right? So, all right, Mrs. Smith, I know that you were sent to me because your dermatologist thought that you have contact dermatitis and you have that biopsy that shows contact dermatitis. You don't have contact dermatitis. You have eczema, and everybody knows the term eczema, so they're very like, oh, okay, eczema, yeah. All right, you've got eczema. Now, you have a specific type of eczema called atopic dermatitis. And that's like saying, eczema is like saying you got a headache. Atopic dermatitis is like saying you got a migraine headache. Again, people understand that. So now they immediately are on board with me of the idea of the difference between eczema and atopic dermatitis, right? So it's like a headache, but it's like a migraine headache. Now, what is going on with atopic dermatitis? Your skin is supposed to look like this. And anything that gets on your skin is supposed to just sit on the surface. Well, in you, because of genetics and age, your skin looks like this. So you've got gaps in your skin, that now anything that gets on your skin is getting into your skin. Once it gets into your skin, your immune system is overreacting to it. Now, Mrs. Smith, I know the first thing that you're thinking is, well, let's figure out what's getting on my skin and I'll get away from it. Well, that isn't gonna work, because it's things like your own sweat, the natural bacteria and yeast that live on your skin, the chlorine and the calcium and the magnesium and the water supply that you bathe in, air pollution, pollen in the air, having clothes touching your skin, residual laundry detergent in the clothes, the residual chemicals from the dyes and fabric finishes in the clothes. So even if we figure out, right now today, the thing is the water. And if you got a water softener, you would get better. Your body is still gonna be looking for something new to react to. And because they'll often be like, but I changed my moisturizer and I got better. Oh, so you've been cured permanently now? Well, no, I got better for like 2 months. And then it came back again, because your body is always looking to react to that stuff that's getting through. Now, luckily for you, for the first time ever, we have medications that work really well. They're nothing like the steroids that you've used, you know, for years. They're nothing like the creams or the pills. They really are new drugs that both help to close these gaps up and help to prevent your immune system from overreacting to anything that got in. All right, so that's my spiel that really, having honed that in hundreds and hundreds of patients of trying different ways of explaining atopic dermatitis, that really is a 30-second to a minute explanation that really puts you and the patient on the same page of that we've got the gaps in your skin and your immune system's overreacting to what gets through, all right? So you can't get away from or change these things. Really frustrating, because you might find something that gets better for a little. Now, if they really push, like, I am not going to go on medication. I want to find the underlying cause. If they're not going to go on treatment, I don't want to be their doctor, right? I'm very happy to keep trying to look for things with them, but not while I'm leaving their atopic dermatitis uncontrolled, right? So I tell them, we can do this once you're better. We can keep looking for things. We can try and take you back off treatment later if you want. Very rare that I have somebody like this, but I am not going to be able to get somebody better by looking for an underlying trigger or cause. I will tell you, I had so much to cover with the kind of the medications that we have. The one thing that is really super, super helpful now, we have really good randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials that probiotics help. And new data keeps coming out showing that even adult onset atopic dermatitis has a different microbiome abnormalities compared to childhood onset atopic dermatitis. So the answer now that we can, the easy answer now that I give whenever they say, why did I get this? Right? My answer used to be, nobody really knows. We don't know. Genetics, you have kind of virus. I don't know, whatever. I don't know why you got this when you were 41, right? And you didn't have it for the first 41 years. Now we actually have a reasonable answer for that. My answer is, well, it's actually the intestines in your bacteria got out of balance. And so you know how you've noticed how food like kind of is a trigger for your atopic derm? Well, it's not that you're allergic to the food. It's actually that the food is feeding the wrong bacteria. And so it's all the food additives, the preservatives, the processing of the food, the hormones, the antibiotics, all of those things in our food have made your intestinal bacteria get out of balance. That is getting your immune system fired up, and that is why you got this. And so we don't really know how to fix it with your diet, but there is a probiotic I want you to start taking that's going to help address the cause of your atopic derm. And the probiotic that's easiest, it's from a brand called Now, literally N-O-W, Probiotic 10, 25 billion. You get it on Amazon. It's about $25 for a 3-month supply, so it's really cheap. And patients, that is another thing that flips them over into being a therapeutic ally with me. So I just went from being just trying to push drugs on me like every other person I've ever seen to, oh, he wants to address the cause of my eczema. I want to address the cause of my eczema. I've actually had people say, you're the first doctor who's ever wanted to address the cause. So I'm like, yes, I am the best doctor that you have ever met. No question about it. But it gets them on my team so that then they realize that we're on the same team, right? So it's building, and then they're much more receptive. Do I think the probiotic helps much? No. I think it helps very little. But it gets them on my team, right? We're on the same team now. All right. So luckily for you, we finally have safe treatments that actually work, blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm going to give you two general options. All right, so Mrs. Smith, first I'm going to give you two general options, and I want you to tell me which one sounds better. And then based on which one sounds better to you, we'll talk more about it. Okay, so we can either put you on a pill that it's going to work really quickly, but it does slightly weaken your immune system. The other option, a shot that you're going to have to give yourself about every 2 weeks, works a little bit slower. The pill starts working in a day or two. The shot starts working in a week or two, but the shot doesn't weaken your immune system at all. So again, two options. Pill, don't have to give yourself shots, works really fast, but slightly weakens your immune system. Shot, works fast, but not quite as fast. Gonna have to give yourself a shot every 2 weeks, does not weaken your immune system at all. Right, so those are the bullet points that I give them. And again, that is testing lots of different ways of explaining this. The vast majority of patients will really be either, I can't imagine giving myself a shot, and so they will want to do the pills, or they will say, I wouldn't want to do anything that might mess with my immune system, so they want to do the shot, right? And so again, it's not me telling them which drug is best for them, it's me telling them, what's important to you, right? So that's my initial spiel to them, right? Shots, you give yourself every 2 to 4 weeks, start working 1 to 2 weeks, pills once a day, do slightly weaken your immune system. If they pick the shot, then I go more into the detail. Okay, so probably there's about a 70% chance this is going to work amazingly for you. There's probably a 1 in 10 chance total that you're going to get an annoying side effect, but there are no, and I'm really clear, there are no dangerous side effects at all, right? About a 1 in 10, 1 in 20 chance of getting an annoying side effect. But if any of those happen, you're just going to call me. We know what to do about it. And you're going to give yourself one shot every 2 weeks. The other one, so tralokinumab, a little bit newer. So I describe it as more targeted than dupilumab, right? Which we don't really know if that matters or not, but it is true. It is more targeted since it's only blocking IL-13. May have a lower risk of annoying side effects. We don't know if it does or not, but it may have a lower risk of annoying side effects. But the real difference, you're going to give yourself the shot every 2 weeks to begin with. Once you get better, we can switch your shots out to once every 4 weeks. And that really does make a fair number of patients want to go on tralokinumab. So the slower, absolutely, but more targeted chance to go out to every 4 weeks. If a patient really says to me, which one would you go on? I try really hard to never answer that. I try to more be like, well, really the difference is here. This one's been around longer. We're more certain about how it works and that there's not going to be any surprises with it. But you are going to have to keep giving yourself the shot every 2 weeks. This one, not been around as long. So it's conceivable there'll be some kind of a surprise with it at some point. But good chance you're going to be able to get to every 4 weeks. Which is more important to you, right? So I'm always trying to go back to which, because they really are both very good drugs. If they pick the pill, so the way that I talk about JAK inhibitors with patients. Okay, so great. First, it does slightly weaken your immune system, but the only problem that we have seen from that is an increased risk of getting shingles or getting a cold sore that then spreads all over your body. Luckily, we have a really easy way to prevent that. I'm gonna prescribe a pill called valacyclovir. Basically, it's a vitamin that prevents cold sores and shingles. That is literally how I describe valacyclovir because it is so safe and so cheap, right? It's $6 a month to be on 500 milligrams a day, doesn't have drug interactions. I'm just totally hoping that at the end of this talk, Dr. Rosen isn't going to come up and be like, well, actually, Matt, people who go on long-term valacyclovir go blind after 2.5 years. And I'm going to be like, shit. But I'm pretty sure that at 500 milligrams a day, valacyclovir is extremely, extremely safe. Now, right, valacyclovir vitamin prevents cold sores and the shingles, and it is going to come with warnings from the pharmacy that I don't want you to get scared by because I don't think that they're real risks. But it's going to sound really scary. It comes with warnings to talk about things like heart attacks, blood clots, strokes, death, cancer. And it comes with those warnings because a different medication used for a different disease did have those risks, and the FDA wants you to know about that other medication. But all of the information we have about this pill used for eczema, it doesn't have any of those risks based on the information that we have. Now, if they then say to me, so you're sure it doesn't increase my risk at all for those? I say, no, I'm not sure. Just like, you know, if I was setting somebody up, would go back to my date analogy, if I was setting somebody up and they were like, will you guarantee me that he is never going to be a jerk? I would be like, I'm not going to guarantee you that I'll never be a jerk, right? So you never have proof, right? So if they say I want proof, we don't have proof that there's no risk, but there's no indication anywhere that there is any risk, all right? Now, the other thing that people always ask me about JAK inhibitors, and I'll address it right now. So you wouldn't put anybody on a JAK inhibitor who has any cardiovascular risk factor? No, I that doesn't bother me at all because I don't believe they increase the risk anymore. The only reason I care at all about somebody's cardiovascular risk profile is if they've got a high risk profile, it's more likely they're going to have a heart attack or a stroke or whatever. And even though I'm very comfortable that the JAK inhibitor wasn't a contributor to that, I don't want to get the phone call of, oh, Dr. Zyers, that medication that you prescribed my husband that you said was safe, he died of a heart attack last week. And me being like, well, was he like, in me thinking in my head, okay, he was an obese, diabetic, hypertensive, non-compliant, and eating a cheeseburger while he was in bed smoking when he had the heart attack. But no, it was in their mind, it was the JAK inhibitor. So the only reason I care is just I'm trying to avoid that phone call. Right, that conversation, but I truly, heart of hearts, and I've looked at every bit of data that is out there, there is no increased risk that anybody can find. All right, so now talking about the JAK inhibitors more is specific, right? Rapid reduction in itching, rapid improvement in atopic dermatitis, efficacy directly dose related. So the smaller the dose, the less they work, the higher the dose, the more they work, but the immunosuppression is also dose-related. We have head-to-head trials versus dupilumab that we'll look at. What we know, JAK inhibitors are faster at normal doses, so the starting dose, 15 of upadacitinib, which is Rinvoq. Rinvoq is upadacitinib, Cibinqo is abrocitinib. At their normal starting doses, 15 of upadacitinib or 100 of abrocitinib, their efficacy is pretty much identical to dupilumab's over 16 weeks. At their higher doses, their efficacy is better over 16 weeks, but at 32 weeks, it is very possible that dupilumab catches up to them. The studies only went out to 16 weeks. And then safety, you just heard how I talked about them. And again, these are just the practical issues. Upadacitinib is approved down to age 12. The reason it's approved down to age 12 and abrocitinib is not is just that there's a lot more data about upadacitinib. It's just been around longer, right? It's been trials for 10 years. It's improved in 5 different indications. There's just a lot more data out there about upadacitinib. And I say that because it's not like there was a safety issue where the FDA was like, ooh, in 14-year-olds who are on Cibinqo, we're not going to approve that. It was just not enough data yet for the FDA. Avoid of severe hepatic impairment, abrocitinib down to 18. It says that you can, in the label, it says that you have to do 3 months on the 100 before you can go to the 200. In upada's label, it doesn't give you a time frame. So a differentiating factor there, you can increase the dose of upadacitinib more quickly. And I usually make that decision at about a month because in the vast majority of people, I would say 80 to 90% of patients, I don't need to increase the dose. But at a month, really, I'm looking at how much better is your itch. If you're itch, because we get most of the efficacy for JAKs in the first month. Contraindicated for the first 3 months if they're on antiplatelet drugs. No good reason I've been able to find for that. And avoid of severe renal or hepatic disease. If they do have an elevated creatinine, you can't adjust the dose. So that is kind of a nice factor where you can individualize based on that. Both of them you want to avoid in pregnancy and lactation. I don't require women to be on contraception, but I prefer it if they are. Right? That's I think of these drugs the exact same way I think of spironolactone or doxycycline. They're very short half-lives. So I tell them, are you trying to get pregnant? If they're trying to get pregnant, I'm not putting them on a JAK inhibitor. If a woman of childbearing potential is not trying to get pregnant, I have no problem putting her on a JAK inhibitor, and I tell her, if you find out you're pregnant, the second you find out you're pregnant, stop taking it, right? So I treat it just like I would spironolactone or doxycycline. You're going to check a TB, Hep B, and Hep C at baseline, and then you're also going to check CBC, CMP, and lipids at baseline. Abro, according to the label, you're going to recheck it in a month. Upadacitinib, you're going to recheck it at 3 months. That's a difference in the label. But really, if they are stable at that first recheck, when people ask me what I'm doing, having done all of the trials and treated hundreds and hundreds of people and check labs in them every month because that's what you do in a trial, if they're stable at the first redraw, I'm going to be checking labs once a year. Right? These are not drugs where lab abnormalities are the big issue. They just aren't. They have very, very, very low rates of lab abnormalities. Now, if there was a lab abnormality at that recheck, then I'm probably am going to check again 6 weeks or 8 weeks later to make sure that it's not continuing to trend in a direction where, oh my gosh, this is something that I'm now worried about. As I said, I start every single patient on valacyclovir 500 milligrams QD. I do not care if they've been vaccinated against shingles. I don't care if they ever had chickenpox as a child. I don't care if they've never had a cold sore in their life. I don't care. There's literally not any reason I would ever not start someone on valacyclovir. I do have, now that said, I have 2 patients who are not on it. And that is because they were just like, I don't want to take it. I don't want to take another pill. Do I have to take it? And I'm like, no, you don't have to take it. In my mind, I'm like, you're an idiot if you don't take it, but you don't have to. If you want to be an idiot, you can be an idiot. They didn't want to take it, right? So I still, in that situation, gave them a prescription for it, said, get this filled so that if you get a cold sore or you start to get a painful rash on one side of your body, immediately start taking this, right? So, I don't force anybody to do anything. But that makes way more sense than the shingles vaccine. So I don't care. I don't even tell them to get the shingles vaccine. I don't even bring it up. I don't mention it because as long as they're on the valacyclovir, the shingles vaccine really isn't going to matter. And we don't have any data that the shingles vaccine actually maintains its protectiveness. It may very well be the case that even if you got the shingles vaccine, you go on a JAK inhibitor, you're still just as likely to get shingles. The JAK inhibitor may prevent the shingles vaccine from maintaining its protection. We don't have any data around that at all. So it's just I don't care about the shingles vaccine. Efficacy, it is shocking to me. So in the trials, what I would always hear from patients is, oh my God, I took my first pill and like 4 hours later, my itching was totally gone. Like, I was waiting for patients, I was still waiting for them to be like, I screwed the cap off for the first time, and my itching was gone. I must have smelled the medication, right? When you look at the actual data, so that's always the difference between what patients remember and what actually happened. So when you look at data from daily diary entries, it takes a day or two, but by the time it's a month or 2 months or 3 months later, they don't remember that it was a day or two, they just remember that it was super, super fast. Right, so it, efficacy, so I do tell people, it's a good chance your itch is gonna start getting better in the first 24 hours. In the first week, I think your rash is gonna be a lot better. Most of the improvement happens in the first 4 weeks, but you do get continued progressive improvement for 12 weeks. And as you guys know, I'm not somebody who likes to, I always think of it as I need to know all of the data, but my job is not to puke data on you. My job is to tell you the interpretation of the data, right? So on the left, this is upadacitinib 30 milligrams versus dupilumab. I want you to look at the graph on the upper left, right? So you see upadacitinib got there faster, and at the end of the 16, I believe it was 16 weeks, can't remember if it was 12 or 16, and I'm too old to be able to see the slide that well. But at the end, still about 10% better. On the right, this is abrocitinib versus dupilumab. So the blue, so look at the upper one, the blue bar and the green bar are the starting dose of abrocitinib and dupilumab. And again, you see they are very similar to each other. The orange bar is the higher dose abrocitinib. So upadacitinib only studied their higher dose versus dupi, 10% better. Whenever we look at the higher dose of abrocitinib, also about 10% better, right? So, and this is over the short term. When we get out further, so into the 32-week range, it's very possible that dupilumab will catch back up to it. But these two studies really showed us that at their starting doses, 12 to 16 weeks, the JAKs are equally effective to dupilumab. Now, this is just the upadacitinib monotherapy pivotal phase 3. Main thing I want you to see here, again, looking at that upper left, is just how steep that graph is. So how quickly, whenever I say that people get most of the improvement in the first 4 weeks, that's the first 4 weeks. This is the abrocitinib. Scale is a little bit different, and you absolutely, in atopic dermatitis, cannot, in most disease states, so psoriasis, for example, I'm okay with kind of comparing study to study. Really, really hard to do that in atopic dermatitis because it matters a ton. There's so much heterogeneity in the disease that different countries, different parts of the world, different times of the year, there's so many external factors that affect atopic dermatitis, you can't look study to study. Now, if in this study, this drug worked for 20% of people, and another drug had a similar study that worked in 90% of people, I would be like, yeah, I think number two is right. But small differences, you really cannot take anything away from the atopic dermatitis trials. Now, what about dupilumab inadequate responders? I talked about this. So, first column here, chance of getting it on ABRO 100 in phase 3. So this is just their normal phase 3. No, they hadn't been on anything first. They maybe 6% of them had been on dupilumab in the distant past, but just all comers, random, right? That's how likely you were to get it. Next column, if you got it on dupilumab, so and let's look at the EASI-75 one. If you got EASI-75 on dupilumab, they then stopped the dupilumab, waited a month, and started you on abrocitinib. 90% chance that you got EASI-75 on ABRO. So responding to Dupixent tells us it's almost certain that you're going to respond well to ABRO. The really interesting one is the next one, though. If you did not get EASI-75 on dupilumab, you've got a 67% chance of getting it on ABRO, which is even higher than the number in all comers. Now, the assumption here is that, to some extent, the dupilumab pretreated them. So it got their eczema a little bit better, and so then the ABRO was not starting from as hard of a spot to get to. But this really tells us that being resistant to dupilumab, not having a great response to dupilumab, does not predict that you're going to be an inadequate or substandard responder to abrocitinib, right? So this is a real differentiating factor. If I've got, because I have this data, I'm now, when I think about, you know, how do I differentiate the two different JAK inhibitors that we have. Upadacitinib, we have more data. So it's just been around longer, we have more data. That is the biggest, strongest factor for upadacitinib. Abrocitinib is more JAK1 selective, so it is the more selective of the two, so I can describe it as a little more targeted, and it has specific data about dupilumab inadequate responders, right? Those are the two biggest differences that I can find between the two drugs. So I already took you through the interpretation about that. Just what about other diseases? This is something I always want to say when I'm giving like a promotional talk for them. If prednisone, but this is like the least compliant statement you could ever make. If prednisone will work, a JAK inhibitor will work, right? They are that broad spectrum of anti-inflammatory drugs. It really is amazing that almost any disease where prednisone would give people relief, a JAK inhibitor will give them relief. And these are what I think of the equivalent doses. Now, safety, right? Immunosuppression, increased risk of blood clots, main issues that have people worried, zoster and MACE, VTE, right? MACE, major adverse cardiovascular events, VET, venous thromboembolism, best data, comparative trial of upadacitinib versus adalimumab in rheumatoid arthritis, comparative trial of tofacitinib versus adalimumab in rheumatoid arthritis. So two very similar trials. And so we can look at the difference in the two, and then the longer-term, larger data sets from the atopic dermatitis trials. So tofacitinib versus adalimumab. Tofacitinib is Xeljanz, FDA-approved for rheumatoid arthritis for about 10 years now, and it has very different JAK selectivity compared to the JAKs that we have. But the main thing that I want you to take away from here, this data, these were not small changes, right? So look especially down at the bottom. Total cases of pulmonary embolism. People on adalimumab or etanercept had 3 PEs. People on tofacitinib had 33 PEs, right? So now there's more people on them, but so it's a huge increase, right? Not a like, oh, there was 2 more cases. And why that's reassuring is that if the JAKs that we have in derm had a similar effect, it should be pretty obvious, right? Because we're not talking about a small difference here, okay? Now, we've got a study that's at upadacitinib versus adalimumab in rheumatoid arthritis. This is a 3-year study, very similar setup to the one that I just showed you. And what I want you to see here, look at MACE, right? So the white bar, incident rate 0.1 in people treated with upadacitinib, 0.5 in people treated with adalimumab. So not only was it not higher, it was 80% lower, right? VTE, 0.2 versus 0.8. 75% lower. So, right, could not be more reassuring. Could not be more reassuring. And then this is kind of showing the all the different things that they looked at. The main reason I put this in here is because part of it is like, well, maybe this was just like a didn't show risks. They picked people really well so that they went. The ones that we know are real risks. So zoster and CPK elevations, substantially higher in the upadacitinib groups. So it does tell us that this is reliable data. Right, so that's really helpful and so reassuring. And then this is me trying to put all of the information together. The key rows here, right, VTE, we've got the upadacitinib and abrocitinib data, and then the last column is atopic derm. So just if you have atopic dermatitis, what are your chances of getting VTE just in general, totally irrespective of drug or anything else? 0.31, so that means 1 case per 300 patients per year, right? The rates for upadacitinib and abrocitinib, not elevated compared to that. When we look at the risk of MACE, 0.92, so roughly 1 event per 100 patients per year. The rates with upadacitinib and abrocitinib, lower than that. So again, all of the data tells us that this is not a real concern. And then this was a meta-analysis that just published in the last few months, looked at all the studies that compared JAK to a placebo or Dupixent, cohort studies of AD in general. The risk of VTE in patients with AD was 0.23. The risk of VTE while on a JAK was 0.15. The risk of VTE while on Dupi or placebo was 0.12, right? So part of why I put that in there, there in the package insert for dupilumab, there were 2 or 3 people who had VTE events. Right, so it just happens to normal people, right? DVT and PE are not stunningly rare events. This is not like progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, right? Where it was like if you put somebody on an immunosuppressive drug and then they get that, it was the drug. There's no like that just happens to people, right? This are things that just happen to people, right? So no evidence of increased risk. The couple of other things just to quickly pull out another difference between the two different drugs, upadacitinib has a higher rate of acne, abrocitinib has a higher rate of nausea. Really, neither of those has ever been treatment or dose limiting for me. The acne tends to resolve spontaneously within about the first 2 months. It's not like it's exacerbating underlying acne. It causes this weird, it's more of an acneiform eruption to me than true acne. I haven't seen them worsen what I would call underlying acne. The nausea with abrocitinib, I've actually seen that more in younger people. I have to take it with food, and it seems to help dramatically. So the highly effective JAK inhibitor summary. No indication of increased risk of MACE and VTE. Now, again, that it hasn't been proven that there's no risk, but there's been no risk seen. Hard to see a major difference between the two drugs. 12 to 16 weeks, equally effective, but faster than dupilumab over longer periods. We don't know how they compare to dupilumab. Zoster risk is real. IL-13 blockade with tralokinumab. So it's 600 milligrams sub-Q on day one, then 300 milligrams sub-Q every 2 weeks. Each injection is only 1 ml, and so it's 4 injections on day one, and then 2 injections every 2 weeks. Believe it or not, having now put, I don't know, probably 70 people on this drug, patients do not care. If they don't have a problem giving themselves an injection, it's like a black and white thing. Either giving myself an injection, I could never do that, or I can give myself an injection. They don't care about the four is a little much, but that's only the first dose. But the one versus two, I have yet to have a patient be like, oh my God, I could do one, but there's no way I could do two, right? The real thing is actually much more injection anxiety. So what I'll have patients tell me is, oh, if I give myself my shot on Thursday, and this, it doesn't matter if I'm talking about dupilumab or tralokinumab, if I give myself a shot, starting on Monday, like my palms get sweaty, my heart races, like I have trouble sleeping, then I give myself my shot on Thursday, and I'm like, well, wasn't that bad. But then next time, I get anxious again for the 4 days before I give myself the shot. So it really does, the number of injections is a big deal to us. Whenever we talk about it, we're like, oh my God, some more shots. Patients just don't care. Now, it's also an interesting question. I will often put it to patients that it's smaller shots, right? So the dupilumab shots are 2 ml shots. The tralokinumab shots are 1 ml shots. So you're giving more shots, but they're smaller. So same amount being injected, just smaller injections. But you can reduce the frequency to Q4 weeks. That is the selling point for tralokinumab. And that really is impactful to patients. This is, again, their data. The biggest takeaway for us, it is a drug that really hits its peak at 32 weeks. So it starts working quickly, but it's just a slower curve than the other drugs. This is just a beautiful way of looking at this data. So each bar represents one patient. So this is at week 4. So already, right, this is at week 4, 1 month in, the vast majority of people, 90%, are already seeing improvement, right, at week 16, at week 32. So it really is a drug that works very well, and it starts working quickly. It's just got a less steep curve than the other drugs. This, now what I want you to mainly look at here, lower left, right, the first blue line that's dropping down, that is the 16-week point. The next blue line over is the 32-week point. And again, this is just showing you it's a drug that hits its peak at 32 weeks. The median improvement was 93%. So 50% of patients got 93% better or more, right? So it is a very effective drug, just relatively less steep curve than the other drugs. The reason there's that little gray box in the middle where the line goes down, the line breaks, then starts to the lower again, they built into the study a little bit of a gap where people were off for about a month, maybe a couple of months, and it was to really show that you've got really good recapture. It's very rare that if you stop it, let their atopic derm come back, you restart it, it typically continues to work. Main thing that I want you to see here, down at the bottom, infections and infestations. Tralokinumab, 41 patients or 2.5%. Placebo, 35 patients, 5.5%. This is where it shows us this 50% reduction in skin infections, which is related to the increase in antimicrobial peptide production. So probably less effective than dupilumab in the short term, very possible it has similar efficacy in the long term, the 32-week range. Patients love the possibility of Q4 weeks. They don't like that it's two shots, but it's okay. Safety profile may be better than dupilumab's. You may get less red face. You may get less arthralgias. Neither of those are like dangerous things, so that isn't that big of a difference to me. Conjunctivitis risk is probably similar. We think that's an IL-13 effect, But as I said, possibly less of the red face, which is seborrheic dermatitis in most cases, psoriasis or arthralgias, and we do not know. So one of the common questions I get is, if dupilumab didn't work, will tralokinumab work? Don't know. Nobody knows the answer to that yet. Or if they got conjunctivitis on dupi, will they get conjunctivitis on tralo? Again, just don't know, right? And tralo's brand name, since I said the brand names for the JAKs, tralo's brand name is Adbry, just in case you don't know. And they are working on a study to use a different device so that they'll have fewer injections. Topical ruxolitinib summary, this I'm just gonna go through really quickly, really simple. Think clobetasol with no side effects, right? That is what the easy way to think about ruxolitinib, ultra high potency steroid, works even faster, but doesn't have any of the steroid side effects, right? The atrophy, telangiectasia, rebound, those kinds of things. I don't think there's any systemic safety concerns as long as we stay below 10% body surface area. There's just the data, great. I always feel like I have to put it in there. Safety, there is 6% systemic absorption. So that's why I say I think there is zero safety concern as long as we stay below 10% body surface area. It's FDA approved up to 20% body surface area. I really think of it as a 10% or more. This is my safety analysis of kind of how much would likely get into your body, 1.8 milligrams a day. Starting dose when used orally, because it is an oral drug, is 10 milligrams a day. We're 80% below the exposure whenever it's used orally. So complete opposite of existing non-steroidal topicals. We're used to non-steroidal topicals being not very effective, slow, and having a lot of side effects. Just not the case with ruxolitinib, and is not going to be the case with the other topicals that, the other two that have already gotten approved for psoriasis this year will likely get approved for atopic dermatitis in the next year or so. Right, so the one thing that is beautiful about it, the speed of onset, and that it's only one tube. There's not the, hey, use this one on your face, use this one on your body, use this one on your hands, which patients are never sure what they're supposed to be using where. Literally, it's, here's this tube, put it anywhere you got eczema, anytime you got eczema. Like, that really makes compliance so much better, right? So this is the way that I talk about it. And then dupilumab update. What's new with dupi? Just got approved for prurigo nodularis, as we all know, but being studied for hand and foot dermatitis, pemphigoid, pruritus of unknown origin, chronic urticaria, hepatic pruritus, and keloids, although we now know pretty well it doesn't work for keloids. Also being studied for allergic contact dermatitis. Approved down to 6 months of age, right? And just a life changer, an absolute, absolute life changer for these kids and families. And it's actually really easy to give injections to little kids. Right, it's easy to hold them down and give them the quick shot. Although after listening to DeShanna's talk the other day, I was like, maybe I shouldn't tell people that I hold them down. But it's just once a month that we hold them down and give them, and it's a quick shot and it's okay, right? But life-changing. The data underspeaks to the way that this affects these kids and these families. We talked about this already. IL-4, IL-13 cause keratinocytes to produce less antimicrobial peptide. That's the major cause of staph overgrowth. By blocking that, dupilumab, we now have multiple studies showing a normalization of the microbiome on dupilumab. All right, so decreases the amount of staph, the amount of good bacteria, increases on your skin, so it really is fixing that microbiome. So end result is fewer skin infections. The dupilumab side effect, no documented dangerous side effects at all, so I truly describe dupilumab to patients as completely safe. Right, it has those annoying the annoying side effects that we're going to talk about, right, that about 10% of patients will get, the facial erythema, new-onset psoriasis, new-onset arthralgias, new-onset conjunctivitis. The way that I describe these to patients, okay, totally safe, but there's about a 1 in 10, 1 in 20 people will get something annoying. Like the annoying things, you might get like bloodshot eyes or might clear your eczema up and give you a different rash, or you might get a little bit achy. None of them are a big deal. Anything weird at all happens, just give me a call. Right, that is literally my discussion about this stuff, because I don't want to over-worry patients, right? I don't want the nocebo effect, right? So the placebo effect is, oh, this stuff is amazing, it's going to work great. That increases the chances it's going to work. I was thinking of the plus-sebo effect. Then you've got the nocebo effect, where you're like, oh, a lot of people get nauseous and headaches, and all these horrible things. Then it is much more likely that they're going to call you and say, oh, my God, all of these horrible things happened to me, the blah, blah, blah. So I try and really minimize how much I talk to people about this stuff. But so all of these, the best hypothesis is that these are Th17 processes. IL-4 suppresses Th17. The excess IL-4 from your atopic dermatitis was basically treating your seborrheic dermatitis or your psoriasis or your psoriatic arthritis. When we treat the atopic derm and make the IL-4 go away, now we've stopped treating that other disease and it can show up for the first time. Other interesting Dupi info, remittive effect. So when somebody does really well on Dupi, if you stop it, whether it's for insurance purposes or they just want to stop it, there's a good chance it's going to be 3 to 6 months before their atopic derm comes back. Now, that's in somebody who is completely clear, right? So I get somebody who's like, can I try stopping it? What I always say is, if you're completely clear for 6 months, we can try stopping it, and you might get 6 months of not having to be on it. I had a woman just come in this week where I'd forgotten about her. It had been 2.5 years and before her atopic derm came back, after we got her clear on Dupi. So you really do have a potential remittive effect, and we believe that's because of the normalization of the microbiome and barrier function. Now, people ask, is it really not immunosuppressive, right? These are all different case series or case reports of people with active malignancy, people with HIV going on dupilumab, and it was fine. Molluscum, it's really important that you know this. Dupilumab makes molluscum worse, but then it makes it go away, right? So it's the beginning of the end sign, right? So if you don't tell patients that, your mom's going to call you, that new shot that you put us on, he's got all of these boils and abscesses all over his body, and those molluscum got so much worse. That is the beginning of the end sign, right? So that is, the dupilumab has now allowed their immune system to recognize the molluscum and attack it. That means the molluscum is now going to go away. And so it is really important that you know that, so that if you put a kid on it who has molluscum and that happens, there's the initial worsening of molluscum. You don't want to stop the dupilumab. You want to keep treating through it and tell mom this is their immune system recognizing and attacking that virus. All right? So now the data that we have on systemic JAKs, it looks like they just make molluscum worse. And so HIV doesn't get worse, cancer doesn't progress, molluscum goes away, no infections get more common. I don't think you could ever prove something wasn't immunosuppressive, but there really isn't any more evidence we could ask for. All right, so that is it. I know I dumped a lot of information on you. Thank you.